Blog Talk Radio.
All right, folks, this week I'm actually not going to introduce myself because I have Nick Sampson, a former guest of ours, who left me a nice message introducing me. Here goes.
What, am I listening to myself?
That's me. Your turn.
Oh, okay, so you did get introduced. Well, I want to introduce myself. I'm the tornado turned demigal.
All right. And Flaky Tom should be on any second now. He's probably surprised that we're on target here, on time for once. But we do have a lot to cover. Our special guest tonight is Forrest the Meat Cleaver Pets. And he has a 26-10 record in MMA, including 12 knockouts, 5 submissions, and 9 decisions. Just coming off a win over Christopher Curtis, June 1st, last Saturday there, at the NAAFS Fight Night in the Flats 9. It doesn't say right here where exactly that was, but we'll talk to him about that, and we'll also have to talk to him about the fight I saw him in Worcester, Massachusetts, at Lucian, God of Martial Arts, which was actually Butterbean's big event. We had him on just before that, and got to meet him in person there at the event, along with Boss Rutan, who helped me get a spot on a website where they think I'm a WWE wrestler. I don't know if I sent you that before, but there's a site out there that has a picture of me and Boss. It says WWE's Rich Bergeron and Boss Rutan.
You didn't send me that.
So, Boss is a real nice guy, too. He's very friendly with the fans. Everybody who's coming up to him, getting autographs for him. And somebody even offered to buy him a drink after the fight. And he said, no, I don't drink. But that fight at Mushin against Ralph Johnson, May 21st, 2010. And I was at the cage side there. And, of course, we got a lot of boxing coming up this weekend. We're going to have to talk about.
June's going to be a very busy month for the sport of boxing.
Yes.
And that's good. You know, whenever there's events going on, that's good. Like, now, next weekend, I'm only going to be able to make one of the cards. That's the one in King of Prussia that Tom's going to. But they got 2 events next week, but one of them I'm just going to watch the televised version of it, and that's up in Bethlehem, PA, which is close to Allentown, probably about 40 minutes from me. And that's going to be on NBC Sports, with Bryant Bye-Bye Jennings, undefeated heavyweight, obviously continuing on, his rapid ascent, trying to get a fight with one of the Klitschko brothers. And we'll go more in depth with that probably next week. And then, of course, the fight next week in Valley Forge will be attending. Tom will be attending. My dad will be there. And, Rich, you know what the shame of it is that you can't make it? The biggest shame of the whole event is, I was talking to a friend of mine about it, if you would have went, 3 people sitting together, probably the only time in history, 3 people sitting together that have all fought Jesse Baja.
Oh, well.
One of my teammates in LHU, who knows a couple of the guys on the card that I also know. So, he's going right now debating on, who wants to get the tickets. I told him I'll do it, but I think he has an in, so he's going to try to see if he can get them at a discounted price. And he fought Jesse Coy. He actually fought him 2 before I fought Jesse. And especially the second time, which was at our LHU Room Show in 1998. Very, very foul-filled fight because of Jesse's octopus style. And if you go back on YouTube and rewatch my fight with Michael Jordan, you'll see this guy, Joe, cheering in the background with a cast on his hand. Because he said, yes, he just basically dropped his head at one point when he was throwing a right hand. he broke his hand on the top of Jesse's, you know, concrete skull.
Yeah. He elbowed me a couple of times. I said something to the ref and almost got penalized myself.
You know what's funny? Just about the same thing, talking about getting penalized. The first year that I was boxing at Lock Haven, which was 1995, regional tournament at Penn State. Now, I used to always bitch that Penn State used to get 3 to 4 shows a year, and Lock Haven, we would get one. Yet our one show would outdraw their 3 shows combined. But they would always get the regionals, and of course, you know, always a little bit of meat cooking in there. And I was playing a kid named Clint Schultz. And Clinton was a short, stocky guy like me, and he was really taking the fight to me in the first round. And I threw a jab, and he sidestepped and ran the top of his head in my face. And my nose starts pouring. I'm clinching them, and I turn to the ref, and I'm like, yo, he just headbutted me. And he goes, no talking or you'll get penalized. So I'm like, you're going to penalize the wrong guy here. The guy just hit me with a third hand, shot me in the top of his head.
Well, and then you could always retaliate like I did when I was in the sectionals of wrestling in high school. The only year I ever got that far. And I was wrestling a guy who I'd wrestled a few times before. Pure muscle, dude. And he punched me right in the nuts from the all fours position there. Just followed through, chopping the arm, and punched me right in the nuts. So I got up and I kneed him in the face. So the ref took points off us both. What can you do? I wouldn't have won the fight anyway. He beat me earlier in the year, but that was a particularly tough day because I saw the captain of our team lose to a guy I beat during the regular season, and that was in the finals of the sectional. So I would have went to the state tournament if I wrestled at my natural weight that year. Anyway, we got Psychic Tom on.
Welcome, you know, you brought up a good point there about the referee saying no talking or I'll penalize you. Now, I don't know where the rule comes with that. Is there such a formal rule?
I don't think so.
Well, I know in collegiate boxing that the competitors are not to talk during the bout. And it wasn't like I was talking to my opponent. I was actually making a comment to the referee. In fact, I know in collegiate boxing, and I'm not sure how it is, And I believe they softened the stance on it. But when I was there 15 years ago, the coaches could not coach from the corner during the rounds. The coaches were actually forbidden to speak. And you'll see in many of my tapes, Dr. Cox was always the converter. Now, obviously the fans can talk. But the one time that Coach Cooper, our assistant coach, didn't make the trip, Dr. Cox offered my dad the chance to help in the corner, and my dad said no, because my dad's a very loud, and you'll meet him next week, Tom. My dad's and he yells, you know. And my dad's like, no, he goes, because I can't stay quiet in the corner. so my dad actually took a position with a little walkway up there for that fight, and that's where he set the camera up, and the whole fight, he's sitting there, come on, you got to move. You got to use your jab. You got to circle. The southpaw. You know, keep your foot outside. And he was yelling the whole time. But I remember one fight in particular, my junior year, like Dr. Cox would always get warned. He'd be like, come on. Come on, you're better than that. And he'd just put these little short little, like, just phrases real quick. And I remember one time, my junior year, I'm fighting a kid that ended up going and being a national champion the following year. And he's still a very close personal friend of mine. And he was bigger than me, and he was ahead going into the third round. And I hit him with a body shot. And he goes back on the ropes, and he's hurt. So I started firing some hooks at him. And Dr. Cox is like, said something. The referee stops, sends us both the neutral corners, and is ejecting him from the corner. I'm like, you got to be shitting me. At the worst time. So then... And then Dr. Cox is arguing with the referee, like, well, what are you doing? And the ref says, no, you go back. You're like, go back, you know, back to the locker room. And Doc's arguing, and I'm like, Doc, get the hell out of there. I got him hurt, you know. I only got, like, a minute and a half to come from behind, and I got him stunned. Just get out of the way. Just go back. And I ended up losing that decision. And then the next time I got him hurt, my shoelace came untied. It was seriously a comedy of errors that night.
You know, though, it comes down to this. This is why so many people get fed up with the amateur ranks, because yelling is a part of the game. I mean, that's the way it is.
Absolutely.
I mean, there are so many things that we could go on, but just, see, like, I know in the pro ranks, and I remember when Ali fought Floyd Patterson the first time, and there was a lot, it was a very nasty build-up to that fight, because Ali specifically said, he won't call me by my name. He's disrespected my faith. I'm going to punish him. And so he kept up the talk. And the fight was a mismatch, in essence. But I remember he kept up the talk. And finally, in the fourth round, the referee said, stop the chatter. Well, of course, Ali didn't listen to him. And I think it would be impossible for Ali not to talk. But as Sports Illustrated was saying, that there's really nothing in the rule book, in the pro ranks, where you have to shut up. Now, when our guest tonight comes on, Forrest, we'll talk about when he fought Charles Crazy Horse Bennett. And he said Crazy Horse was talking to him throughout the whole fight, you know. So it just goes on all the time. And that's why I can't understand the rationale of the amateurs being so different than what hopefully you're going to aspire to if you turn pro. I mean, I'll never get it. But
Paul Daly versus Josh Koscheck fight, where Daly got so pissed off at Koscheck for talking to him that he punched him after the fight.
Well, I mean, that's inexcusable, but I mean, to me, talk is a part of the psychological warfare if you know you can get through to someone that way. I mean, Ollie was the master. I mean, he was the master of getting people off their game plan, except when he ran into Frazier. Frazier talked right back to him.
Yeah, what was that conversation? Where he goes, I'm God. He goes, what do you say? I'm God. He goes, well, God's going to get whooped tonight.
Oh, I heard Ollie met his match on the plane once when the stewardess said, champ, you have to buckle your seatbelt. And he said, Superman don't need no seatbelt. And she said, Superman don't need no plane either. So he would meet his match a few times. But, yeah, that's just sickening to hear this. And I never knew that was enforced as at the college level. I had no idea. Mm-hmm.
And like I said, if you go back and you watch some of my tapes, obviously in a lot of them you hear my dad. But in other tapes, I don't think you'll ever hear Cooper say anything to Coach Cooper. He was always good with hand signals, almost like a baseball coach. It's like if you had a guy and you gave him a standing eight count. And he would always tell you, and Coop was adamant about this, and if you didn't do it, you heard. If you had a guy stunned and the referee was giving him a standing eight count, and you went to that neutral corner, Coop would say, don't look at your opponent. Look at us. Because we'll try to hand signal you on what to do. Maybe it was a flash knock, and you caught a guy with a shot, and it went out from him, and you're going to attack like you got him hurt, and you don't. You could be, running into disaster. Or there'd be times that you might have, I remember one, I was fighting a guy from Navy, and I caught him with a short little left hook right in the corner, and he ran into it. He was moving to his right. I stepped over the left hook. I didn't think it was that big of a deal, but he went back and bounced off the ropes, and I missed him with a run. Yeah, which I was like, I didn't think I hit him that hard. But if you can look back on the tape, he actually stumbles about 5 feet backwards when the referee broke us apart. I didn't see that. So I remember looking over at Coach Cooper, and he was like, he was waving like, come on. He goes, when the referee says box, he's like, you move as fast as you can, and you go after him because he's hurt. And well, yeah, you watch a lot of my fights. You'll hear Dr. Cox in there like, come on, look how quick you are. Come on. Well, don't let him hit you with that shot. And he'll say little things. It's if the referee's being a stickler, that's the problem. And the referee we had that night, he was one of those guys that they said, like, if he was in one of his being a stickler moods, you were screwed. There was nothing you could do about it.
Well, here's my question. What is the rationale behind that? I mean, did they feel that this elevates the dignity of the activity? I'm not getting this. You see what I mean? Why would they say no yelling from the corner?
I wish I could give you an answer on that, because I never understood it either.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I always thought it was a dumb rule.
Yeah.
There were a lot of things that I saw in college boxing that, you know, I really disagree with a lot. Maybe because sometimes they didn't favor me. But they were, they did not give the same credit for body punches, which I've noticed amateurs, they don't. But yeah, that was always a big stickler of mine because that affected my game. but one of the ones I'll never forget, and I'm surprised Dr. Cox didn't get thrown out of the corner for this one, but it was a night we were at Penn State, and I was my sophomore year, and my fight had gotten canceled because I was supposed to fight a kid from Buffalo who didn't, the team didn't make the trip. They had a snowstorm up in Buffalo. It was in early December. So since Coach Cooper wasn't there that night, Dr. Cox asked if I and another kid that had his bout canceled would help in the corners that night. And, you know, kind of, you know, learn how to work the corners. And since Doc was, you know, in his 60s and 300 pounds, a lot of times he would just like to stand up on the apron and, you know, have Cooper or whoever else get in the ring. So that night I was going to be getting in the ring, and I was coaching my one teammate, this kid Chad, who's now an official himself. And Chad was playing a kid named Phil Small, who I ended up fighting twice. And Phil was a tall kid. He was kind of awkward. And his freshman year, or his first year of boxing, he was a junior. He lost, I think he was a 1-5, you know. But you could tell he had some, but he was just so, he was like, a baby deer that, like, hadn't got his legs underneath him yet. And I remember saying, I'm like, man, I'm like, why do I ever get to fight someone like that? And then the first time I see him, I'm like, he ends up being, you know, I'm like, oh, Dan, he's improved. Well, he's tattooing Chad. And Dr. Cox is getting furious. Dr. Cox is in the corner, and he's like, damn it. And Phil was a tall kid. And to fight a tall guy like that, you either got to be right in his chest, or you got to be right on the outside and time your rushes and time your counters.
Right.
Chad was standing right in his power zone, right on the end of his punches, and he's getting tattooed. And Dr. Cox is getting madder and madder. And I remember Dr. Cox turned to me as the fight was, like, or as the first round was ending. The doc, to help her out. He would say something like, I'll tell you what to say, but I want you to get in the ring and I want you to give a lot of the instructions. Doc turns to me and goes, I'm doing all the talking. So I get in the ring with the spit bucket and we sit Chad on the stool. And Dr. Cox is yelling at him. He's like almost smacking him in the head and tearing into him. And I remember thinking to myself, that will never happen to me. I will never allow that to happen to me. My very next fight, I got in the ring and I had tassels on my shoes. And the referee was being a stickler that night. He goes, you're not allowed to have tassels on your shoes. I'm like, wait, there was a kid from Penn State that had them on. Why can't I have them on? So they were cutting them off. Now I'm off my game already. And I had a, because I had longer hair at the time, I had like a band kind of holding my hair back. And it came untied and it was slipping right over my eyes. So the referee called a time on that, and Dr. Cox was furious. And I remember when that bell ended the first round, I remember thinking, I don't want to go back to that corner because he's going to tear me. I just saw what he did to Chad 2 months prior. I started walking back to the opposing corner like, shit, you mind if I sit here for a few minutes? He got me back to that corner. He tore my ass off. I came back and won that fight. But he's like, you better never put that in hair band in there again. He's like, I don't care if you shave your head. That'll never happen again. But, yeah, that was definitely interesting. Then about a year or so later, this kid from Penn State that had the tassels on before and never got penalized, they penalized me, and I was pissed. Well, not penalized, but I, you know, got warned and had to cut him off. He took a year off, and he came back, and he had them things on his shoes. Well, guess who was the first person to protest? Me, and I wasn't even on the card. I said, bullshit, you cut them off mid-ring. Well, yeah, but I'm like, no, you did it to me in this very ring a year or two ago. Fuck it, now you're dealing with him.
You know, I'm surprised you didn't get a Maginale haircut in the corner.
Remember that? Yeah. If I didn't have Hedger on, I might have.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we got to move on here. We got a lot to talk about before we have our guest on. We could talk about the glory days all night long. Anyway, we got a couple big fight cards, boxing matches for tomorrow night, June 7th. Big night for the Bruins, I know. Could clinch the get into the Stanley Cup if they could beat the Pittsburgh Penguins, who I'm sure Tony hates as much as the Pittsburgh Steelers, right?
Remember I said I wanted to talk to you about something, but I wanted to wait till we got on the air.
Right.
First of all, I wanted to check before I say anything. Tom, are you a hockey?
Nah, never got into hockey much.
Okay, good. That way I can trash a team and not offend you.
Okay.
An Ohio guy. I know a lot of times Ohio and Pittsburgh don't get along, but you know, I want to make sure here. I hate the Penguins, and I'm glad the Bruins are ahead of them 3-0. But Rich, don't forget what happened 4 years ago when your team was ahead 3-0.
The Flyers killed us.
Yeah, don't get overconfident, but please sweep these sons of bitches out so I can trash their fans.
Well, I have a personal beef with the team because they punched out my countryman there, Patrice Bergeron. My namesake. He had a rough fight, and it wasn't even during play. It was like right after the buzzer rang for the intermission there. And some jerk from the Penguins goes after him. He still got the scab on his nose after scoring the winning goal. They're interviewing him last night, and he's got this big scab on his nose. Split his nose open. So I guess I gotta teach my brother some boxing skills.
they have that mentality because I remember last year, Crosby's a kid, the whiny little bratty kid that gets everything. I remember him, kid like that in school, got in a fight with a friend of mine, and my friend whipped this kid's ass. And the whiny bratty kid, they get sent to the principal's office, and my friend's getting yelled at. And they're like, and the other kids are like, oh my God, are you okay, or whatever? And I'm like, the one teacher was like, the other kid started it, the bratty kid was the one that started it. He just kind of ass kicked. But that's the thing with the Penguins, when they don't get their own way, like they did the same thing with the Flyers last year in the playoffs, and they're like, we don't like them. Oh, great, we don't like you either.
All right, well, getting back to combat sports here. We got, like I said, two big fight cards on Friday. One's on Showtime. That's going to feature Jorge Melendez versus Nick Brinson in the main event. That's a 10-round junior middleweight fight there. I don't have the records in front of me, but the co-main event there is Jonathan Vidal versus Mario Munoz. That's an 8-round bantamweight fight. And, of course, we have Friday night fights on ESPN2 starting at 10 p.m. Eastern tomorrow night. And that main event is John Molina versus Andrei Klimov, I don't know how you pronounce that one, but that's 10 rounds, lightweight fight. And the co-feature is Farah Ennis versus Anthony Hanshaw. That's a 10-round light heavyweight bout. And I don't know much about either of those four guys, any of those four guys.
I want to see how he's going to come back. You know, he had that loss to Antonio DeMarco last September where he was knocked out in one round. But he came back with a very impressive knockout, four-round knockout in the beginning of the game. Molina, who also has a win over Hank Gundy, 25-2, 20 knockouts. He's tall for 135 fighters. He's 5'11 almost. Now, his opponent in this fight, let me pull up his information. I just had it up. I apologize. Okay, we got Andrei Klimov. He is 15-0, 8 knockouts. But I can honestly say I've never seen him fight. So, obviously, Molina is your known quantity here. We don't know much about his opponent. So, he's a little bit shorter. He's about 5'9", so we're going to have a little bit of a height advantage for Molina. Now, this is a part that I'm very interested in because I've seen both players. Actually, that might be the main event for Anthony Hanshaw. Hanshaw is 23-2, 14 knockouts. He had two draws in there. That's his last fight in February was his only draw. He has his only two losses. The unanimous decision was to Roy Jones Jr. in 2007, and the Scottish lost to Andre Burrell in 2008. So he hasn't lost in 5 years, but he's only fought three times since that. Now, his opponent, Farah Ennis, was a Philadelphia kid. His only loss was a majority decision loss a couple years ago with Atlantic City. In fact, he was an undefeated fighter that he lost to. Farah's 20-1 with 12 knockouts. So, I'm going to go with Farah Ennis today. He's really young. And Hanshaw's around. I mean, Hanshaw is 35. Hanshaw also has a couple of wins over another friend of mine, Ron Doty, back in about 13 years ago. Well, Ron, who I know very well, and like his training for the comeback now. How do I do on that book?
Pretty good. Pretty good. You proved your nickname to be accurate. Your other nickname, the Brain Man of Boxing. Anyway, we got a bunch of heavy guys fighting over in Germany on Saturday. Main event, I think, is the main event. Anyway, this could be just the list of there's three 12-round fights, cause, so it could be any one of these that's the main event. But in the United States, you can watch these starting at 2:30 p.m. Eastern on Fox Nation, whatever that is. I never heard of it. Anyway, Marco Huck is fighting Ola Aforlabi at cruiserweight. That's a 12-round bout. Robert Vogue, I guess, W-O-G-E, is fighting Darius Seck in a 12-round light heavyweight bout. And Edward Gutnecht is fighting Richard Vidal in a 12-round light heavyweight fight. And there's also a 10-round cruiserweight fight on the card between Iago Kilads, actually, and Yuri Kayembre Kalenga. Mouthful there. So that's over in Germany.
Especially when you look at that one fight you just mentioned, that cruiserweight fight between Marco Huck and Lola Afalabi. That's an interesting fight. Yeah, Marco Huck, 35-2, one draw, he's got 25 knockouts. Well, his one loss was a majority decision to Alexander Povetkin a little over a year ago, and he did not lose that fight. I watched the fight, and I thought Huck won that fight. He had Povetkin hurt. He had him stunned dead in the final round, and he did not get the decision. His only other loss was a stoppage loss about 5 years ago to Steve USS Cunningham in the title fight, got stopped in the 12th round. Now, his fight here with Al-Falabi is a rematch. They fought, looks like, just about a year ago, in May of 2012. And it was two judges had it 114-114, while the third judge had Huck winning 115-113. So, obviously, we're looking at a close fight here. Like the Huck is 35-2, one draw, 25 knockouts. Al-Falabi is 19-2 with 9 knockouts. He lost about a year ago that fight with Marco Huck. In fact, this is the third fight. It looks like they fought in December of 2009 with Huck winning a unanimous decision by scores of 115-113 twice and 116-112.
Well, and we also have dueling HBO and Showtime cards on Saturday night. Big fight on HBO is Chad Dawson versus Adonis Stevenson. That's a 12-round light heavyweight bout. We also have Euryurkis Gamboa versus Darley Perez, 12 rounds in the lightweight division. We got an 8-rounder between David Lemieux and Robert Swierbinski. That's a middleweight bout there. Jose Pedraza versus Sergio Villanueva, 10 rounds in the junior lightweight division. And another interesting bout on this card, Elider Alvarez versus Alan Green, which is a 10-round light heavyweight bout.
And looking at Dawson-Stevenson's fight, this is going to be Dawson's first fight since that destructive loss to Andre Ward back in September. And Dawson's, you know, making a lot of excuses regarding that now. You know, he was bitching about, first he bitched about John Scully, Iceman, our good friend who trained him for that fight, said he didn't do a good enough job. And then lately he's been bitching about HBO forcing him to have to come down so much in weight. But the fact of the matter is, why are you saying this 9 months later? You know, the fight's long overdue. So, you know, we got Dawson on the back, 31-2, 17 knockouts. But how is he going to rebound from 9 months off and a, like I said, an absolute destructive loss to Andre Ward? Now, you got Adonis Stevenson. Now, he is going to be the hometown fighter here. He's a Quebec guy. And, you know, Dawson's venturing into his area, which he's fought before. You know, Dawson's fought up there, but he got that loss to John Pascal up there. And Stevenson is 20-1, 17 knockouts. His only loss was back in 2010. It was a second-round knockout to Darnell Boone, which he avenged in his last fight. Now, Darnell Boone, going into that fight in 2010, was 16-15-2. Going into that fight last year, Darnell had, you know, was still hovering around 500. He was 19-20-3. And Stevenson got his revenge via sixth-round knockout. Now, looking at the other fight on this card, which I think is possibly the interesting fight, because I like watching Urias and Candela fight. He's fast, he hits hard, he's got good skills, but at the same time, you know, he's vulnerable enough that he makes it interesting. He's been knocked down on several occasions. So we got Gamboa here, who's 22-0, 16 knockouts, you know, tremendously fast hands, good power, but like I said, he's vulnerable. Now, he's playing this guy, Darlais Perez, who I can admit I've never seen before. He's from Colombia. It looks like he's had, he had a couple fights in California, one in Florida, but mostly he's been fighting in Colombia. He is 28-0 with 19 knockouts. I can't say I know much about him except for the fight. You know, somebody's O has got to go, and you got to figure Gamboa's got to be your favorite.
True, true. And on Showtime, we have a fight from Carson, California, fight card. Also at 10 p.m. Eastern on Saturday night. Going up head-to-head against the HBO card, we have Marcos Maidana versus Josecito Lopez. 12 rounds in the welterweight division there. Also, Arislandi Lara versus Alfredo Angulo. Another 12-round fight in the junior middleweight division. And if that's not enough, we've got Jermell Charlo versus the other Hopkins, Demetrius, a 12-round middleweight fight. And another interesting fight on this one is Gerald Washington versus Sherman Williams. Washington's an ex-football player, and Williams is a phenomenal fighter, a heavyweight fighter. He's been in with Holyfield and a bunch of other big-time heavyweights. And Washington, I think, is only like 9-0, and Williams has like over 50 fights, I think. So that's going to be an interesting fight to see how good Washington really is.
Let me take a look. Let me see what I can pump into my little computer up here and see what my little brain says on these fights. We got Marcos Maidana main event here. Maidana is, you know, your quintessential puncher. He's 33-3 with 30 knockouts. So the three guys that have gone the distance with him, you know, pretty good swings there. I remember his fight with Amir Khan. And he had Khan, I mean, had him beat in the 12th round. Actually, one of our former guests was one of the three fighters that went the distance with him, not being DeMarcus Chop Corley. Interesting, he got Maidana here. Now, he's taking on Josecito Lopez. who in the grand prix back in September was blown out by Canelo Alvarez. You know, he had the win over Victor Ortiz where he broke Ortiz's jaw, which thrust him into a fight with Alvarez, got knocked out 3 times before he got stopped. He's 35, 18 knockouts. The only stoppage loss was to Alvarez. Maybe Maidana in that fight. If you look at our next fight on the card, we have Arasami Lara and Alfredo Angulo. Now, here's the situation. We're going to have more of a boxer versus a puncher. We have Lara, he's a southpaw, who is probably most well known for a controversial loss to the Punisher Williams a couple years ago. But everybody on HBO thought Lara won just about every round, and he ended up losing a majority decision. And that was one of the fights on HBO where, I mean, it had everybody up in arms, and it was, I think all three judges got suspended in that fight, if I'm not mistaken. He turned around, had a knockout win over Ronald Hearns, had a unanimous decision over Freddie Hernandez. Then in his last fight, he fought Vane Matarosyan, and that actually went to a technical decision when there was a cut over Matarosyan's eye. Lara was coming on strong in that fight when the cut happened, and it ended up being a technical draw. The judges actually had the fight even. So now he's fighting Angulo, who was running roughshod over the division a couple years ago. Had a loss to Kermit Cintron, which a lot of people thought he beat Cintron. Had a two knockout wins over both of the friends of mine in a row. Gabe Rosado, tough fighter, he knocked him out in 2 rounds. And that's really impressive considering that Rosado was able to not go down against Danny Golovkin. He also knocked out Harry Bill Yorkie, who Tom and I will be seeing next week. Joel Julio knocked him out. And he was knocking everybody out other than James Kirkland. And he had Kirkland down, but Kirkland came back and took him out. So now, he's come back with 2 wins, a knockout to Raul Cesares, and then his decision win back in December over Jorge Silva. Good fight there, too. So now you're going to get a boxer versus a puncher fight here. And I'm going to have to favor the Cuban boxer and Lara. I think he's going to be able to stymie Angulo, frustrate him. And I think it's going to be a decision for a late-round stoppage. And then the third part I'm going to break down on the card is Charlo and Hopkins. Jermell Charlo, fresh off a win over the aforementioned Harrier Joe Yorgi, stopped him in 8 rounds back in that he's a 29-30. He's fighting Demetrius Hopkins, the nephew of Bernard. But at the same time, he's not Bernard, let's say that. He's 33-2, 13 knockouts. His only loss is a split decision to Kendall Holmes and a unanimous decision to undefeated Brad Solomon a couple of years ago. But Charlo is a younger, fresher fighter here. He's a rising star, and I think you'll see him carry that into a decision win over Demetrius Hopkins.
All righty. Well, here's a test for the boxing right now. Has there ever been a professional card with father and son fighting on the same card?
Father and son on the same card. Well, George Foreman makes a comeback. Maybe he can fight on the same card as his son, Monk. I'm trying to think, and some famous father and sons that were out there. Probably the one that would pop into my mind, and I'm probably going to be wrong here, but I would think maybe the Johnson, that being Harold Johnson and his son Marvin Johnson, and that's the only thing I could possibly think of. I'm trying to remember the father and son combination that both fought Archie Moore. That could be a possibility. But I don't know, Rich. You got me stumped there.
Well, this article is claiming that the first one is happening this weekend. Never happened before, so there's a reason why they're stopped, I guess. If this article is correct, I don't know. But, I tend to think there's got to be somebody that did this before this. But apparently next Thursday over in Australia, or down under in Australia, in Auckland, there's going to be a fight with a father and son on it, and it's Francois Botha and his little white buffalo on the same card. It's actually not his nickname, but his son, Francois, is fighting Joseph Parker in the feature bout, and it's going to be 8 rounds, and then his son, Marcel, is fighting a guy who is... one of four brothers, and all three of the other ones are singers, according to this piece anyway, so kind of interesting. But anyway, he's going to have a 4 3-minute round fight, and his nickname is Mayhem. So we'll see if he lives up to that. He says he's got a good left hook and quality combinations, says he's an exciting fighter and wants to be an entertaining fighter, and I don't see this guy's name right in front of me, his last name. Oh, Jeremy Sebastian. And he's had one pro fight. And Botha, actually, the younger Botha, hasn't had much of an amateur career, but he has sparred with his father for years. So his father says, I taught him everything he knows, but not everything that I know. We'll see.
How old is Francois now? Do we have an idea?
Let me see if it says here. 23 years old.
I mean the father.
Oh, Francois has got to be almost 50 at least, I think.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
But still doing good out there. Isn't that real controversial fight with the rugby player down there, Sonnyville Williams, I think? And now he's coming back to Australia to fight another guy. He's also going to be coming out with a book, apparently, according to this article. It says a lot of the chapters are already written, but there are still a lot of things I want to do. You never know, I might end up on Oprah. Say that.
Well,
so that's that.
I got one for you guys. I just saw this on a Facebook page, KO Digest, regarding the latest quote from Bernard Hopkins. And I would say Bernard the Executioner Hopkins, but apparently he is no longer the Executioner.
I thought I heard this already.
Yeah, Bernard, and I'm sure our listeners will love this one, and I'm going to read the quote for you. The breaking news is that I'm an alien. I just found out a month ago. The doctor will be here before the fight. The fight week press conference, hopefully to explain this, but I must confess that I am not human. No, seriously. I realize that Pluto is no longer a planet now, so I'm from Mars. I've definitely retired the executioner. You will not hear me mention the executioner. I'm an alien. Now I'm in this world, but I'm not of this world. There is no aging process for me.
Well,
just nicknamed the Martian.
So now here's my question, because Bernard, when he usually comes to the ring, he would have, like, the executioner's mask on, or the hood, or... He used to come out with the guys, he used to carry the big axes. So what's he going to come in now, like a spacesuit? Or one of those, like, big, like, heads with, like, the two eyes on it and some little, like, antennas on them?
We'll see. Oh, nothing surprises me. Anyway, let's switch gears here to mixed martial arts news. New York is now the only United States, that is it considers MMA not legal, professionally anyway. Because Connecticut just legalized MMA. And Mark Ratner of the UFC, he used to be a boxing commissioner out there in Nevada, confirmed it last night, I guess, that they're the 49th state to legalize MMA. And, of course, places I've been to down there, Mohegan Sun and Foxwoods, some places that come to mind. I know that I guess they could technically have fights since they're Indian or Native American run, but I think now you'll see a UFC fight at one of those places since that's happened. But it's pretty big news. We'll see what happens if that puts the pressure on New York to do something. But apparently, I just read a few weeks ago that there's some kind of scandal going through the New York legislature over some kind of affairs, cover-ups, all kinds of crap going on that's going to prevent the MMA legalization bill to go to the full assembly this year. But they're still fighting for it, so it's not this year, it'll probably be next year.
Yeah, the last I remember, there was one legislature in particular that was really opposed to it, and I heard he was going to retire, but I'm not sure what the status is on that. But hopefully he's gone, and then that'll stop a lot of it, a lot of the opposition.
And BJ Penn is back in the news. He's contemplating a return to fighting in the lightweight division of the UFC. The door is still open for Penn to return in the near future, according to UFC Tonight. And he's 34 years old, from Hawaii, currently training to assess whether or not he is mentally and physically prepared to get back into the sport, according to his quotes. And, of course, he's been up and down through the weight classes, but it's going to be in the lightweight division if he comes back. He's 16-9-2, and made his MMA debut in the UFC on May 4th, 2001, at UFC 31. And fought in the inaugural UFC lightweight title fight at UFC 41 against Jens Pulver, losing by majority decision.
You know, it's interesting that comes up, because there was just a thread on the Underground about his training methods. And for a while, he was training under Marv Marinovich. I don't know if that name rings a bell with anyone. But when he was, and he was using that system, his cardio was just off the charts. He fought both Kenny Florian and Diego Sanchez, two cardio machines, and he hung all the way. And apparently there was a disagreement about what time of day he was going to do what, because his skill coaches wanted him to do his fight training in the day and then in the evening train under Marv, and Marv wanted it the other way, and Marv was pretty rigid, and so they went their separate ways. And, you know, I'd noticed before that BJ was kind of training himself. And so the question now is, should he swallow his pride and go back and rehire Marv? Well, we'll see what happens.
I know I've seen a video of BJ actually in the shallow end of a pool up to his waist, and he can jump out of the pool and onto his feet on the edge. So that tells you what kind of strength he has in his legs, anyway. I don't know if that's part of his daily routine, but you know, I don't remember exactly when that was, but I'm sure he could probably still do that little trick. Sounds like it's tough, looks like it's tough. I don't know how many people could do that, but they can. Anyway, Dana White is not a big fan of him coming back, wants him to retire, and has said so on multiple occasions, but I don't see him offering him a job either, like Forrest Griffin, so maybe he's thinking he needs the money or something, but we'll see. And UFC on Fox Sports 1, and the first show in Boston finally has its main event, and it's pitting a former UFC light heavyweight champion against the best promoter in the sport today. Chael Sonnen is going to be fighting Mauricio Shogun Rua, and that's going to be an interesting fight. Chael was trying to get a fight with Wanderlei Silva, but apparently that deal fell apart. So now it's going to be Rua. And this came about, I guess, because the other Nogueira, Antonio Rogério Nogueira, fell out of a fight with Rua due to an injury. That was supposed to be part of the UFC 161 card, I believe. Anyway, Sonnen's been verbally sparring with Silva for a few weeks, trying to get a fight, but it never materialized, and now he's going to fight Shogun. But it's not too early for Sonnen to start selling this one, so his quotes are, "I went after Wanderlei because he's the worst guy I could find, record-wise. He's the worst fight in the UFC. I know what you're thinking. What about Mirko Krokop? You're right. Krokop was terrible, but Wanderlei is actually a little bit worse. I couldn't get Wanderlei, so I'm going, look, why don't I fight the guy that actually destroyed Wanderlei for years in the practice room?" And that brings us to Shogun. "I like Shogun. I have nothing against Shogun. It's just good, solid competition. But Wanderlei did this to you, Shogun." And, of course, Shogun is a former training partner of Silva's when the two were at the shootbox camp in Brazil, when both were competing in private. And they actually began training again in California, although it's unknown if they still work together. You know, Wanderlei has his own Vegas MMA gym, so I doubt he's from being California. So we'll see there. That's going to be August 17th. And I should have my big lawsuit settlement money by then, so I might be able to attend that one. Maybe I'll even fly you guys up. Here's big news for the UFC. Las Vegan Robert Drysdale has signed a contract with the Ultimate Fighting Championship and will make his debut against Ednaldo Oliveira at UFC 163 on August 3rd in Rio de Janeiro. And Drysdale is 32 years old. He's one of the most decorated jiu-jitsu practitioners and instructors in the world. And he started competing professionally in MMA in 2010. Has a 6-0 record with 6 first-round submissions. So, we'll see.
Well, I'm anxious to see how his stand-up game will work, because now he's in the big leagues, and he can't be one-dimensional. And I'm sure he's been working hard on his boxing and Muay Thai, so we'll find out.
All right. And the big news this week is an ex-UFC fighter moving to Bellator. We have Quentin Rampage Jackson, not only moving to Bellator, but getting a deal similar to King Mo's. He's going to do the TNA wrestling circuit too, TNA Impact Wrestling. And on top of this, he's getting his own reality show on Spike TV, so go figure there. He's he's keeping himself busy. And I guess there was a rumor earlier in the week that Czech Congo was also signed by Bellator, but apparently that's been quashed today by Bjorn Rebney, the CEO. Said, no, we haven't signed Congo, but they are trying to get some people from this Wolf's Lair gym, but they haven't made it clear whether Czech Congo is one of those people they're trying to get. But he was just booted out of the UFC not too long ago for losing to Roy Nelson. Interestingly enough, now Daniel Cormier and Roy Nelson are kind of having a verbal spat, so that fight might be in their future. A couple of fat guys with great skills. So we'll see. But I guess according to Cormier, he wants to get down to light heavyweight by the end of this year. So that might be his last heavyweight fight, if that happens. Anyway, Jackson's Bellator debut has yet to be finalized, but a fall date appears to be a possibility. And he's 34 years old, a 14-year veteran of the sport, and will come into Bellator with a 32-11 record and a 7-5 record as a UFC fighter. And I don't think we could have a show without talking about somebody bashing Dana White and the UFC for fighter pay and other issues. We talked a few weeks ago about Jacob Volkman and John Scholes griping about some of their fighter pay issues and insurance deals. Now, Jason Mayhem Miller, who, as promised, retired from MMA after losing to CB Dolloway at UFC 146 in May of 2012, had a recent appearance on the MMA Hour, and he said he was set to have surgery on his left knee, which the UFC was going to take care of through its insurance, but his coverage expired after the promotion decided to let the process drag on. And according to Miller, it was all part of his former boss's plans. He explains, the UFC pretended they were going to give me the surgery, and they started acting like they were going to fix my leg. I went back, and they dragged it out until my insurance coverage expired, so now I can't get my knee fixed. And Mahan has yet to have the surgery, which he estimated will cost more than $50,000. So he said he's just learned to deal with the pain. His quote is, my left knee, same one I hurt in the CB Dalloway fight. If you're walking around with no ACL for 1 year, Kobe Bryant is a pussy. I'm walking like Hunchback of Notre Dame over here. That's the big problem, right? I'm hurting. But I got so used to ignoring the pain over my entire life from doing the job that I did. And I bet it's a bit of genetics because my dad's done the same thing. Then try to walk through the pain, whatever. Then your foot swells up like a watermelon. Try to work out hard? Nope. So, Miller doesn't plan to return to fighting, admitting now that he has retired from the sport. He is really enjoying his life and has other things to accomplish. So.
Well, more power to him.
So I guess if he ever was planning to return, it'll never be at the UFC.
And John Fitch had an interview too. I guess he's going to be fighting Josh Berkman, and he's in the what is the organization of the world? Can't think of it offhand.
World Series of Fighting.
Right, World Series of Fighting, exactly. And he really had quite a bit to say about the UFC also, I guess. So see how things go for him.
Yeah, some of these guys are going to have to get together and organize here, some kind of lobbying group or something to get these fighter issues changed up and regulated somehow. But one issue that's going to change is the threshold for marijuana drug tests. The World Anti-Doping Agency raised the threshold, and the UFC has decided to do the same, at least for the events that they self-regulate. And the Brazil Commission is also going to do that. And the Nevada State Athletic Commission is considering the change as well. And leave it to MMA Junkie to expose this story. But they said in their article, in standing true to their stance on the regulation of cannabis use in the sport, UFC officials have decided to raise the testing threshold for marijuana metabolites from 50 nanograms per milliliter to 150 nanograms per milliliter. And that's the mark the World Anti-Doping Agency also deemed to be acceptable or sufficient. And Mark Ratner says, when we self-regulate around the world, we are going to go to the WADA standard of 150. So we're starting that immediately. So I guess that's good news for...
cards do they self-regulate, though? Because I know in Nevada, or most states for that matter, just about all states, they have the State Athletic Commission that has the ultimate authority and say-so on that, correct?
Right. Well, if the Nevada State Athletic Commission is considering it, I would think if they adopt it, then that would cause a domino effect across the country.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the UFC is fighting a lot in Brazil, having a lot of cards in Brazil, and that's one of the ones that's adopting it. And every time they fight overseas, they regulate it themselves. A lot of times when they go to different parts of Canada, they regulate it themselves. They do the testing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be actually a significant amount of fights. And if you're a UFC fighter who happens to smoke and the UFC knows about it and you've been either busted before or you've let it be known, then I would think they would try to schedule you for one of those cards where your threshold is higher. I don't know what that means scientifically, how much more you could smoke.
Well, I wonder if this is really a burning, pun intended here, you know, if this is a burning concern with the fans. I mean, really, does anyone care who's, seems like such a misplaced priority.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't seem to be a performance-enhancing drug at all.
No, no, not at all. Oh, well.
So, in any sense, I would think it would actually be a disadvantage if you're smoking, you know, right near to the fight or right before the fight or something. Probably be a little out of it. But anyway, the other big deal on this drug testing advisory panel, or the Nevada State Athletic Commission steroid and drug testing advisory panel, is also discussing potential suggestions for revisions to their policy on performance-enhancing drugs, including testosterone and steroids. The committee is expected to draft an official recommendation in the next few weeks. And among the changes being considered is lowering the acceptable level of an athlete's testosterone to epitestosterone levels from 6-1 to 4-1. And that's also in addition to possible testing for human chorionic gonadotropin, HCG, to require a hematologic passport and the requirement of out-of-competition tests to include both urine and blood samples. So, I guess Pat Healy is probably pissed that this came a little too late for him, but we'll see for some of these other guys. Now, back to boxing here real quick. We've got to, of course, cover UFC on Fuel TV 10, and then we'll get Forrest on, but we do have a boxing story here. From Berlin, the manager of undisputed world heavyweight champion Vladimir Klitschko is threatening to call off his October bout with Russia's Alexander Povetkin over the issue of drugs testing, believe it or not. Klitschko, 37, has been ordered by the World Boxing Association to face Russia's Alexander Povetkin in Moscow with the fight scheduled for October 5th. Povetkin is the regular WBA champion and Klitschko the governing body's super champion, an honor given to him when he relieved David Haye of the WBA belt in July of 2011. Now Klitschko, who also holds the WBO, IBF, and IBO belts, and Povetkin are obliged to fight in order to leave just a single WBA belt holder. But the Ukrainians' camp are insisting Germany's National Anti-Doping Agency handle any drugs testing, while Povetkin's camp wants to use the Russian agency. Should the German agency not be used, there will be no fight, and this is not up for discussion, said Klitschko's manager, Bernd Bunty. And Bunty said Povetkin must also have his samples tested by the NADA-certified institute in Cologne. The Klitschko camp wants to rule out any inconsistencies with questionable analysis by Russian anti-doping agencies. And that's probably a legitimate concern, considering the history of Russia and doping, especially in the Olympics. But anyway, better safe than sorry. I've already seen too much in this business, added Bonte. The WBA has granted a 7-day extension for the fight's details to be negotiated. Bonte also admitted there are still huge gaps in the contracts, not only in terms of the drugs testing. And Russian promoter Vladimir Hurdyanov won the purse bid to stage the bout with a staggering 18 million euro bid, which is $23.33 million. Klitschko is entitled to 75%, which would give him a career-high 13.3 million euros or 17.3 million U.S. dollars. While Povetkin should receive 4.4 million euros or $5.7 million. And speaking of the Olympics, these are two former Olympic champions, and they were due to clash twice before, but Povetkin pulled out in 2008 because of an injury and then backed out a second time in 2010. And I thought that was it for the big story this week, but got a couple more. I guess we'll get to those later. Let's cover the UFC on Fuel TV 10 first, and then we'll get to the juicy, dirty news later on Tito Ortiz's spat with his ex-wife there. I don't even know if they're actually divorced, but I think they're at least separated.
That is really turned ugly. Oh,
yes. But we'll get to the gossip later. We're going to cover UFC on Fuel TV 10, Nogueira versus Werdum. Fabricio Werdum here, 16-5-1, fighting Antonio Rodrigo Nogueira, who's 34, 7-1, otherwise known as Big Nog. This is a really big fight for Verdum. These are two tough guys. They've got great records here in the UFC and in their careers. But I kind of like the experience of Nogueira in this one. Verdum is a tough guy. He's got a lot of skills, but just for some reason I'm going to lean on Nogueira for this one.
Well, Nog has quite a few miles on that transmission, you know. So this will be interesting.
All right. And we also have Leonardo Santos fighting William Macario. Santos is 11-3. Macario is 6-0. We got Thiago Silva back in action. He's 14-3. Rafael Cavalcante is his opponent. He's 11-3. Daniel Sarafian, 7-3, also facing Eddie Melendez, who's 7-1-1. Eric Silva, 14-3, fighting Jason High, who's 16-3. Rony Mariano Bezerra, who's 12-3, fighting Mike Wilkinson, who's undefeated at 8-0. By the way, this fight is in Brazil, so that's why you see a lot of these Brazilian fighters here. It's from Fortaleza, Ceará, Brazil. Rafael Assuncao, 19-4, fighting Von Lee, who's 13-8, one draw. Ronnie Marks, 14-1, Derek versus Derek Brunson, who's 10-2. We got Felipe Arantes, 14-4-1, fighting Godofredo Castro, 9-1. Hildemar Alcantara, 18-5, fighting Leandro Silva, who's 11-0-1. Rodrigo Dam, 10-6, fighting Mizuto Hirota, 14-6-1. Carlos Vemola, 9-3, fighting K.O. Michael Hayes. Must be related to Vinny. That's a unique name there. He's 5-1. And we have, finally, Antonio Braga Nieto, 8-1, fighting Anthony Smith, who's 17-9. And it's another one on free TV, if you do happen to get fuel. I don't, but because I'll be watching it online. And we'll see. And then, of course, the weekend after that, same weekend, you guys are going to be ringside in the casino down there. What is it, King of Prussia, is that what they call it?
King of Prussia, yep.
And that's going to be UFC 161 that Saturday night as well, I think. So, plenty of UFC action coming your way for the fans out there. And we'll see what happens there. But we're going to get Forrest on in a few minutes here. We'll go through this Jenna James story here. And if you've ever watched porn, you know that Jenna Jameson is a pretty big porn star. And true to form, I guess you could say, you know, these adult industry people have issues for whatever reason. And usually one of the top ones is drug abuse. But ironically enough, we have Jenna Jameson accusing Tito Ortiz of drug abuse now. Very weird. Anyway, I think we just dropped Tony. You there, Tony?
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah.
Tony's looking up Jenna Jameson.
Yeah, that's really turned into a mess. I mean, I can feel for all parties. I've had a few situations like that that ended ugly, and it's just a mess.
Anyway, again with you. Ortiz spoke candidly and in length about his destructive. Oh, what happened there? We dropped you. I guess you were looking up Jenna Jameson, huh?
Yeah,
Yeah.
But Ortiz said that Jameson ruined his life and his fighting career. Also, Ortiz said that Jameson refuses to be a part of her children's lives, leaving him to carry the weight of their feud alone. And he says, I'm just trying to do the right thing and take care of my kids and do what's right and not hurt my kids' future. He's doing that already by going on the internet and saying that I have a drug abuse. I have drug abuse and a fake drug test for the UFC and this and that. Whatever. I've worked hard. I have been a world champion before I even knew the chick. Since I've been with the girl, I tried to help her and I went outside my box to try and help. She ruined me. What? I won 2 fights since I was with her and lost 7. I went through so much trauma. All my fans know all the problems I had with her during my fights. It seems like every time that I had a fight coming up, she was getting a DUI or she was on the internet or she was partying and just kind of ruining me mentally before my fights. I had enough with her and I walked away and I took full custody of the kids. For her to say that I keep her from seeing her kids is BS. I give her the opportunity and she flakes. She doesn't show up. And according to TMZ and various other sources, Ortiz and Jameson began a relationship in mid-2006, around the time that Ortiz was rebuilding his UFC career after back-to-back losses against Randy Couture and Chuck Liddell. And right after losing his UFC heavyweight championship, Ortiz quickly surged back with a 5-0 winning streak against Patrick Cote, Vitor Belfort, Forrest Griffin, and Ken Shamrock. But from 2007 to 2010, the same time frame that made up the bulk of Ortiz's domestic partnership with Jameson, the People's Champ never won a single fight, suffering a horrendous 0-4-1 slide that edged him toward temporary retirement. And by the time Ortiz and Jameson split in mid-2011, Ortiz re-entered the octagon for UFC 132, finishing up off against top-ranked Ultimate Fighter veteran Ryan Bader. Shockingly, Ortiz defeated Bader in an upset-of-the-year performance, stunning the younger, stronger fighter with powerful strikes and a quick guillotine choke submission less than 2 minutes into the first round of their bout. Ortiz has notably never tested positive for steroids, performance-enhancing drugs, or any other type of illegal substance, despite a career marked with various injuries, something that he says he endured while supporting his family. And he said, Jameson accused me of drug use. I've been in the UFC for 15 years. I've taken drug tests in every single one of my fights. I take them months before my fight, the month before my fight, right before my fight, after the fight. She can try to bash me as much as possible, but it is what it is. When somebody has a problem like she does, she can't help herself. I tried for 7 years to help her. Right now, it's just about my children. I'm here every single day supporting my kids. She had an opportunity to see her kids. And all of a sudden, she calls the monitor saying she can't do it today. I don't understand it. I don't want to bash her. I work hard for my children. That's it. I tried to help somebody who doesn't want to be helped. That's it. She can sit there and bash me all she wants on social media. Her fans can believe her, but I'm going to court right now. And Jameson's tirade on Twitter hasn't ended at current publishing time of this article. The troubled starlet was continuing to post photos of various painkillers and medicines that she claims Ortiz used to cheat several UFC drug testing screens. So far, no illegal substances have been shown, with the photos showing legal non-steroidal drugs such as prescription ibuprofen. Perhaps the presence of painkillers isn't terribly surprising, though, since Ortiz has been competing in MMA since May 1997. And for her own part, Jameson's own life has been highlighted by heavy substance abuse and criminal offenses. So there you have it. And aside from 3 misdemeanor counts in July 2012, including a DUI arrest, Jameson has recently been charged with battery and assault as recently as this past April for beating her assistant with a brass-knuckle iPhone case. Ortiz continues to maintain none of Jameson's accusations are true, with the two currently engaged in a custody battle over their twin four-year-old sons, Jesse and Journey. There doesn't seem to be any timetable for their end of their legal struggle. So we'll see. And one more MMA story we'll get to a little bit later here. About an Irishman who wants to come back to Boston to fight for the UFC. But let's see if we can get Forrest Pettz on the phone. Just gotta add his number, look it up, and connect them. Gotta thank Tom for this one. So I imagine you know Forrest pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, sure do. We go back quite a ways.
And how did you meet Forrest?
One night, this was fall of 2001, and myself and Denny Daniels, Terry's younger brother, went to a shoot fighting card up in Cleveland, and Forrest was on the card that night. And shortly thereafter, Denny started training and got me in the gym, and we went from there.
Cool. Well, I told you I saw him at a Mushin MMA event back in May of 2010. It was actually a Butterbean show. And I got to meet Butterbean in person there. I fought a guy that was a hometown kid from Worcester. So Forrest was pretty much not the crowd favorite in the fight. And they booed the decision, but he definitely won the fight.
Yeah, he fought Ralph Johnson that night.
Yeah, it was interesting. I looked at Johnson's record on Sherdog, and said something about his affiliation. Was 1983 Chevy Van? That's the promotional company or management company that he went to?
Okay.
Where did that come? 1983 Chevy Van. All right.
Yeah.
Sounds like a great name for a management company, huh? All right, let's get Forrest connected here. Tony the Tornado Pentacal and Psychic Tom Padgett, buddy.
How you doing, buddy?
Good. How you doing, Tom?
All right.
And turns out, Forrest, I actually saw you in action back in 2010 at the Mushin God of Martial Arts event up there in Worcester, Mass.
Oh, yeah.
You were fighting the hometown guy, Ralph Johnson, there.
Right. Guy was as tall as a tree.
Yeah, it's like 6 foot something, I think. Tall guy, weird haircut.
Yep, that's the guy.
And, anyway, you've had a pretty good career. You've been fighting since 2002. Tell us how you got into the fight game.
You know, I just saw it on TV and thought I'd like to give it a try. I actually started back in 99. They just didn't always have all the fights. You know, the record keeping wasn't so great back then. But I saw they were doing some shoot fighting near my house. I stopped up there, watched a few of the fights. A friend of mine, another UFC guy named Jeff Cox, I never met him at the time, but he was fighting in it. And after it was over, he won his fight, and I asked him where I could go to learn some of the stuff. He gave me the address to the gym, and you know, I just went up there and said, where do I sign? And it's kind of taken a life ever since then.
All right. And who would you say is the toughest guy you ever fought?
Toughest guy I ever fought? I don't know. There's, you know, everybody's different. Everybody's tough in their own way. Yeah, I'd say this last guy, Chris Curtis, I hit him with everything that I had, and I just could barely put a dent into the guy, so say he's pretty tough.
Alright. Do you have a favorite submission or style or anything that you prefer in the fight?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Do you have a favorite punch or submission or any kind of style that you kind of lean on?
I mean, my overhand right's always been my best punch. This is for my power, you know, the wheelhouse. My power's always been overhand right. But I go to the body pretty good with my right hand, too.
Cool. And what's your ultimate goal in MMA?
Well, you know, I didn't really have one. Back then, the sport wasn't very popular. And, you know, I just thought I'd like to try it, see where it took me. And I was kind of like a ship without a rudder, drifting wherever the current took me. I got a call from Monty Cox because I fought on some of his shows, and he told me he could get me in the UFC if I was looking for a manager. So I decided my goal would be to win some fights in the UFC, and it was nothing beyond that. And then, you know, once I did that, it's all been gravy since then.
Yeah, actually, you got back into the UFC just after beating Ralph Johnson there in Worcester, so.
Yeah. Right.
Right after I saw you fight, you got back up there.
So. Right. I've looked better. If that's all you've seen in my fights, I've had better fights than that. I was a goofy, awkward fight, but at the time I was going through some technical issues. I kind of got away from what I was good at, and I don't know how to explain it to you. I was like a major league pitcher who went out on the mound and he just didn't, you know, some days he had it and some days he just didn't have nothing because the mechanics weren't right.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I was for that fight. But one good thing about all the experience that I had is that I knew how to win ugly, which that was clearly an ugly fight. But, you know, I managed to just kind of make it an ugly fight and win it that way.
Yeah, it was kind of a controversial one, too, if I remember. I know the crowd was so behind Johnson because he was from Worcester.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, clearly any objective observer would know who won the fight. I mean, basically, the crowd thought he should win just because he didn't get knocked out. But I mean, the guy didn't take a step forward, you know, after the first half of the first round. I mean,
I
won at least two of the rounds. Probably, in my opinion, I won all three rounds. I mean, obviously, I'm biased also, but. If you look at that fight with the sound off, I think it's pretty clear that I won the fight.
Yeah.
Well, I heard something about that, something similar to that earlier in our show tonight, you know, fighting, you know, in somebody else's home gym, somebody else's, their home arena. And, you know, because I fought a lot, in fact, Rich and I both did on the college circuit in boxing. And
sure.
I know there were times. Did you ever have the mentality going into a fight knowing that you could not win unless you knocked him out, or you beat them so badly that it was like almost laughable?
I definitely, you know, I've had my share of fights in other guys' hometown. It's a little different in MMA than it is in boxing. There's a little, they don't bring guys in just as an opponent generally. I mean, I'm sure it happens, but not as frequently as it happens in boxing. But I've had fights, you know, and actually I kind of thought that in that Ralph Johnson fight, I kind of thought they're not going to give me a decision here. I have to go out here and either knock him out or, you know, make it so that there is no question whatsoever. And it was a closer fight than that, and it turned out that I'd misjudged the judges on that one because they seemed to have taken a pretty clear view of the fight.
Yeah, I mean, and I see it both on the amateur circuit. Like I said, I knew, like, during my career, like, sometimes we had to fight at Penn State University. And even though my university was only about 35 minutes away, you were considered an outsider. And there were times, like, I went in there. I remember fighting one guy, and even the crowd thought that I won. He got a split-second decision. And then looking and seeing the judges' cards later, the one judge, who was very pro from the state, gave him every round, including the round that he was knocked down in. Now, Tom and I, Tom's meeting me in the suburbs of Philadelphia next weekend. We're going to a professional boxing card. And it's the same place that I go to some cards. You know, they just started holding them there. And I was telling Tom, I was at a card about 3 months ago. And two of the fights were very close. The one fight I gave to the out-of-town kid by 2 points in a four-round fight. I gave him 3 rounds out of 4. The other fight I gave the hometown kid the decision by 2 points out of 6 rounds. I gave him 4-2. And the one judge gave both of the hometown fighters clean sweeps. And I said, did he just come in here, fill out his cards, and then just go to the bar? You know, he obviously didn't watch the fights. And I said, I felt bad for the two out-of-town fighters, especially the one that I thought legitimately won his fight.
You know, that's the biggest issue. And as part of what has hurt the sport of boxing over the years is bad officiating, you know, bad judging. I mean, there's got to be... I just wish people, there was somebody who was, it made them more accountable than that, that you had to account for. In every other sport, bad umpiring, bad refereeing, you have to account for that. But it seems like in the sport of boxing, and MMA has its issues too, that there's no accountability. You can just put whatever, you can sit there and daydream and put down whatever you want.
Yeah,
I really wish there was a way to clean that up.
And it was funny because before we got you on the air tonight, we're talking about a fighter fighting this weekend on HBO, and he was involved in a fight in Atlantic City 2 summers ago, and the announcers had him winning about 9 of the 10 rounds, and it ended up being, I think the fight was scored a draw, or they scored him losing the fight, and it was so bad that the commission of New Jersey suspended all 3 judges. Boom.
Wow. Well, that's great to hear that New Jersey took some action for that.
Yeah.
And you know, Forrest, I remember Forrest years ago that you mentioned that sometimes you would actually prefer fighting on the road. It was a different. You didn't have the pressure that you did fighting at home.
Yeah, I mean, when you're fighting at home, you know, you think I sold tickets and all these. People came out to see me, and what if I get knocked out? Now, what if I get beat up right in front of my girlfriend? You know, and when you're fighting somebody else's hometown, it almost galvanizes you. Like, you know what? Everybody here hates me. You know, F everybody in this place. You know, I'm fighting everybody. And it kind of puts you in a mentality I don't know, it just makes you feel like a warrior, like you can just go out there and just get ready for battle. And you know what? I think he's the one who's got to worry about getting knocked out in front of his girlfriend. And it always seemed to be easier for me to fight in my opponent's hometown. Conversely, the problem there is, you know, all the close rounds are going to go to your opponent. So
sure.
It does help to have, you know, that hometown advantage.
But what I always admired about you, though, is, you know, you always seem to have the approach fighting. It's like punching a time clock. You know, you seem to just always keep your emotions in check. And I tell you, all the years I've known you, I never heard you ever badmouth an opponent, ever. I mean, I think you would win with class, you would lose with dignity, and win, lose, or draw, you're shaking hands, and you always seem to stick with it. Even after that Dan Hardy, you want to talk about it winning ugly. You remember that down in Canton there, 2006, April 14th.
Sure.
Just what a ugly, nasty fight that was, you know. And,
and
it was close, but, you know me. I mean, I'd tell you, if I thought you came up short, I got to be honest with you, but no, I had you winning that fight 3-2. There were some close rounds, but... You know, Hardy goes on the internet, and he was just screaming about a hometown decision. But I don't know.
Yeah,
it's nice
to go to a fight and have a ready-made excuse if you lose.
Yeah.
You know, no matter how that fight would happen, if you would have lost, it's the kind of character that the guy has.
Yeah.
But I mean, that fight's up on YouTube if anybody wants to watch it and judge it for yourself. But I mean, I knocked the guy down 3 times. I hurt him just about every round, so check it out yourself and be your own judge.
Yeah, and you know, I always liked your work ethic because we'll go back to 2003 when we had the tournament down there at that movie theater in Canton, and you won that, and 2 days, I think it was that Monday, I think you were back in the gym showing me how you got out of the mount when you were, I thought you were in a bit of trouble in the mount there for a while, but I mean, now that's dedication. You didn't even, you took one day off, and you're right back in the gym. That was amazing.
Well, I'm sure the other fighters that you've had on there will tell you that after you win a fight, it's pretty easy to get motivated to go into the gym because you want to go there. And I mean, you know, you got the eye of the tiger, you just want to fight. You feel great about it.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much work ethic that took for me to do that.
Yeah, and then also you have to share with everyone the West Virginia barn fight. Remember that one?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I this is going back to this was in the year 2000, and in 99 we'd a guy named Ron Tucker, I think his name was putting on some MMA fights. I went down there, and none of this stuff is on, you know, my fight record for Sir Dog or anything, because back then they didn't really keep great track of this. But I fought a kid named Steve Whitehurst, and it was at a Marriott. It was a nice ballroom, and, you know, so we had some good fights, and I won my fight. So they invited me back a year later, and they said we changed the venue. So we show up, and they said it's a place called the Halley J. Hubs Arena. So we drive around, we get lost, you know, we look through West Virginia, and we show up on the address, takes us to this farm, and if you look, there's an open-ended barn. It's just Halley J. Hubs Arena. Inside the barn is a ring, some little stadium style seating there, and that's where we fought. I warmed up in a horse's stall, and I've got pictures of the fight. I was wearing wrestling shoes, and I have hay stuck to the bottom of my shoes during the fight. In between rounds, the guy would come out with a big push broom and push out all the hay. Good time.
That is lovely.
It was like the Wild West back then, though. You could do that. I fought Adrian Serrano over in Indiana, and we were hashing out what the rules were going to be right before the fight. They were saying, "All right, you guys want to do soccer kicks in this?" And we were just hashing out what the rules were going to be because there was no unified, there was no regulation.
No,
and,
yeah,
I remember that one too because.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. That was your first. I didn't know you fought him twice because I remember your sanctioned fight with him. That was up in Wisconsin, if I remember.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Well, this fight. I mean, this fight really wasn't sanctioned, but this one is recorded on. Sure Dog. I mean, they send out the results to, Sure Dog and the fight databases. But, that wasn't sanctioned by any athletic commission. But I remember, so they told us, well, push stumps, head kicks on the ground are legal, soccer kicks.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember, you know, this is great. You can have a fight like Pride where you can soccer kick. And all I heard was, you could get soccer kicks. Holy crap, what if the dude kicks me while I'm down? Luckily, that didn't happen.
And then also, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention your fight going back as March of 2006 with Daniel Morales. That fight is known for one of the most unique TKOs. Yeah. Now, the record book says, wouldn't stand up from butt scoot. Okay. Now, the shame of that, though, I felt that was one of your better fights. Because Daniel was maybe a little short on the feet, but on the ground he was one of Brazil's best.
Yeah.
And he got you down
to
the ground.
He was the world champion.
Right. And I think that was, you showed such outstanding submission defense that night and held your own on the ground, and then when you got back to the feet, it was pretty much of a lost cause, and I think he knew he didn't want to stand with you. But I think
right.
that
I mean, that's really the reason that the referee eventually just stopped the contest. I think a more accurate call would have been if they just would have said passivity, that the guy wouldn't stand up. You know, the guy wouldn't get up because he kept getting knocked down, and then he basically, you know, gave up. He's, you know, like lying for me to come into his guard. And when the referee had commanded him to get up, he wouldn't get up. So after doing that three times, he called the fight. So I think passivity would be a more accurate call, but they whoever recorded it as wouldn't stand up from touch.
Yeah,
so that's
that is an absolute classic. And then can you talk a little bit about the Charles Crazy Horse Bennett fight and the the I can't think of the name of it now. Cleveland State University. The Right. Thank
you.
They
call it the Communication Center or the Wilson Center.
Yeah. Now that was that was a sold out crowd that night. That was very exciting. Talk to us a little bit about that fight.
Craig George back then was a little bit a bigger name than he is now, and you know, he's kind of gone on a downward spiral since then. But he had some good wins, and he was just too small for me. You know, he came up in weight from 55 to fight me. I had to make 65 for that fight, but I was the naturally bigger fighter, and even though he fights at 55, he probably could make 45. But one thing about him, he's very athletic, and he was very fast, and that was the first time I had ever fought a guy who hit me with punches I didn't see. You know, where the punches were so sudden, I just didn't see him. That was the first time. Luckily, he just wasn't big enough to really hurt me, I was able to wear him down, and then he shot on me, and I sprawled, and then I got him in a head and arm choke on the ground. What was cool about that fight? Was that that was the first time I fought in such a big crowd, and
right.
They chanted my name, and I just remember feeling that was surreal, because at the time, I never had any lofty goals going into this. I never thought that I never envisioned myself like one of the pros, you know, like back then, Ken Shamrock, or, you know, to me, they were like guys on another planet, so I didn't see myself as one of these professional fighters. And then to have like 10,000 people there chant my name, to me, it was just a surreal experience. It was like, man, what are they doing that for?
Yeah, no, that was exciting. And, you know, we were talking earlier about chatter during fights, and Tony was saying that he was penalized or yelled at once just for saying a word to the referee, and the referee said, hey, no talking. So we had a little segment there on chatter. Now, from what you said to me after that fight, Crazy Horse had a few words for you, didn't he, throughout the fight?
Yeah. He was talking all the time. He would, every time I throw a punch, he would go, woo! Yeah, he was, you know, kind of make mocking noises. But at one point, he said, hey, man, you hit hard. I said, yeah, so do you.
Yeah, and then another exciting one was the first time the King of Cage came to Ohio. Now we're going back to 2004, back February 2004. Mike O'Donnell, a very dangerous jiu-jitsu guy. Yeah, let's talk about
right.
that one a little bit.
Sprawl and Brawl. That was probably the fight that kind of really kicked off, I think, my pro career, because up to that point I just fought fights that not a lot of people knew much about, but this was the first time King of the Cage came to Ohio, and I lit the guy up on the feet. He couldn't get me on the ground. He did in the opening seconds, but I got back to my feet. I hurt
right.
him with a hook, and from then, every time he got up, I just knocked him back down. And like I said, I just sprawled and brawled because I knew he had a brown belt in jiu-jitsu. Back then, it was still a little bit more of the style-over-style fights, you know, striker versus grappler kind of thing, whereas people weren't as well-rounded as they are now. I was
yeah.
kind of lopsided toward stand-up with a little bit of wrestling ability to stay on my feet. And he was kind of lopsided with being on the ground, you know, and not being real durable on his feet.
Yeah, and I remember you were cut up. You had a little bit of bleeding from your ear in that fight, if I remember.
Yeah.
I said I was right beside you.
He cut me on the ear. I
mm-hmm.
should have got stitches, but I did not. And wouldn't you know it, this last fight that I had last Saturday, that very same cut opened up.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I remember that night because I blew my vocal cords out for about two. I was yelling for you so loud. It was about 2 days. Imagine me not being able to talk. You know, I was, it was good for everyone around me, you know. But, that was a highlight. And then the first time when you finally got to the UFC back in summer of 2006, in August, and you decision Sammy Morgan. Let's talk about that. Did you feel that you had that first time octagon jitters? Because this is out in Las Vegas.
Not really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I get nervous for every fight. I have anxiety, fear, for every fight. And to me, it's like I either have it or I don't. It doesn't, I don't have more for this fight than I have for that fight. I get like that equally for all my fights. You know, I've done amateur boxing matches. I felt the same, you know, in fighting in that barn. I was nervous and scared, the same as I was for this UFC fight. To me, it never changes. That's what I tell these guys. Actually, when Stipe Miocic had his first UFC fight, he asked me, like, how do you deal with that? And I told him, it's the same. If you've had fights, you're going to be just as scared of this fight as you were for the last fight. And then mm-hmm. he came back and he told me, what the heck, you don't know what you're talking about. I was way more nervous for that fight than for any fight. So apparently that's just something that's peculiar to me. But the mm-hmm. Sam Morgan fight, I still was maybe a little too apprehensive. I had a little bit too much respect for him on the ground, so I thought I'd just stand up, knock him down and then stand up. My friend Jeff Cox had just fought a guy named Derek Kiesley, and he knocked him down like a sack of bricks. And when he jumped on him, the guy was hurt, but he was able to wrap his legs up. He had real long legs. He wrapped his legs up on Jeff. He caught him in a triangle choke. And that was in my mind. And then, actually, the fight before this, I fought Hardy, and I knocked him down. And when I jumped on him, he got his legs up on me. And I wouldn't say he came close to getting me in a triangle, but he was there. So I had it in my mind, I'm not going to knock this guy down and then jump on him and get triangled. So I would knock him down and then back up and tell him to get up. In retrospect, I probably should have finished.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that was a great start.
You know what, though? One thing about that, though, is that one of the judges gave me that fight 30-23. He gave me a 10-8, and a 10-7 round. And to my knowledge, that's the most lopsided score in UFC history, at least in a three
round fight. Yeah, it's very seldom do we even see 10-8 rounds. Normally, if it's 10-8, it's usually stopped.
Yeah.
Sammy was a tough guy. You knocked him down.
I kept knocking him down, and I think maybe he was scoring the knockdowns. But, I mean, I heard him in every round. What's crazy about that is one of the other judges, I think he gave it 30-25, and the other judge was 30-27. Now,
mm-hmm.
I don't know what you got to do to get a 10-8 round out of that judge. But I tell you, I don't know if 30-23 was too much, but I tell you, it was closer to 30-23 than it was 30-27.
Yeah, that was pretty one-sided. And I'll tell you, Sammy really had a lot of guts to keep going in that fight. You probably had to keep thinking, geez, what do I got? I got to shoot this guy. What do I got to do to stop him?
Yeah, he's a tough guy.
Yeah, he sure was.
Yeah, like I said, I think I could have, I mean, obviously, if you beat a guy that bad, you should have finished, which is probably why that record will stand for a while, because anybody else who's got a guy beat that bad is probably going to finish it.
Yeah,
I'm
exactly.
The only knucklehead who didn't do that.
And then the UFC fight, UFC 77 in Cincinnati, that's the only live one I went to with Josh
Berkman.
What a close fight that was. Mm.
Yeah, you know, that should let you know you never got it in the bag, because I felt like I had that. I lost round one just on takedowns. He took me down, didn't really do anything, but he got me down. Round two, I dominated that round, so we're going to round three even. And the majority of that round is an extension of round two. Every time he tries to take me down, I shuck him off. I pepper him with my jab. And then I go to throw a hook. I threw a sloppy wide hook, and he threw a real short one and caught me right on the chin. Dropped me. And that was I got back up. I kept fighting, but, you know, I got dropped, so the judges gave him that round.
You weren't hurt. I mean,
so.
I
was hurt. I was hurt. But I got back up and finished the fight. You know, that was that. I think there was like a minute left. If I would have ducked one more time, that's the biggest win of my career.
Yeah, and it almost happened. And I remember encountering your wife, and she was really nervous before this one, because this, you know, this place is U.S. Bank Arena, I guess, or what, there must have been 20, I don't know, God knows how many people were there cheering on Rich Franklin, you know, when he fought Silva in the rematch.
Anderson, yeah.
Yeah, when he finished in the rematch. And I remember she was really nervous, and I said to her, I said, Heather, look, your husband has cement in his chin and stone in his fist. Don't worry, he ain't gonna get hurt. But boy, she was all concerned. I know he's gonna be fine. So.
Yeah, that actually that's the one and only concussion I've ever had in my life. Mm-hmm. The only time I've ever even really been hurt by a punch, but after the fight was over, I didn't remember it happening. Actually, initially, I remember after the fight was over, I thought I won because I didn't remember getting hit with that punch. And I looked up at the jumbotron, and they showed me hitting him with that left hook, hitting me with that left hook, and I remember being in disbelief. That never happened. I won this fight. He never hit me. You know, like how did they fake that? So, but then I was, so whatever, I stormed out of there. But then next thing I know, I'm sitting backstage, and I look around and I can see Jason McDonald warming up. And I didn't know where I was at, and I said, what's Jason McDonald doing here warming up right in front of us? So I grabbed Jeff Cox and Marcus Bernelli, and I tell them, hey, I'm about to go play. I got to warm up. I'm not even warm. And I didn't remember the fight. So,
wow.
You know, those guys tell me, you fought, you did real good, but you didn't win. So I said, oh, did I get knocked out? And he said, no, you didn't get knocked out. So I said, oh, hey, guys, I got to get ready for a fight. You got to help me warm up. And so, like we just told you. I said, oh, yeah, that's right. Hey, I got to get ready to fight. I get ready to fight. So they said, all right, go get the doctor. So they get the doctor. And now I don't know if one of the side effects of a concussion is paranoia, but I had it. And I don't know why I was trying to keep it a secret, but the doctor came to me and he asked me, what was wrong? I said, nothing, doc. He says, do you know where you are? Now, I didn't know where I was. So I said, Ohio. It was a pretty good guess. I live in Ohio. You know, I could have been fighting in Ohio.
I'm in Pittsburgh,
so,
it's raining.
The guy says, where do you live? I had moved about a year before that. I had moved to my new address. I couldn't remember my new address that I'd been living at for a year. So I says, I was born in Cleveland. I'm from Cleveland. Doctor says, he's fine. So Marcus slaps me on the shoulder, says, tell him. So I says, all right, I'm sorry, doc. I don't remember fighting, and I don't even remember training the first fight. So he says, all right, let's get a CAT scan. And then I stood up, and I walked outside, and everything came back to me. I remembered the fight, and I remember, oh, I almost won. Everything came back to me, and I was fine ever since then. But it was a scary moment. And so I made sure I took probably 6 weeks. I was so paranoid because I've heard of boxers, fighters, once they get knocked out or they take a real head trauma, they're never the same, and I'm kind of known for having a good chin. I thought, I don't want to lose that. So I made sure I didn't get hit for 6 weeks and and then I came back. I was real ginger about when I came back, and my chin has held up pretty good since then. I've never had a concussion or anything like that ever since.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny that you say that, Morris, because I remember I had a teammate of mine when we were in college together, and he was a guy I sparred with a lot. He was a big, stocky, husky kid. He was you figure if I was around 180 at the time, he was around 200. But, his forearms are huge, and he had the head look like Fred Flintstone. And, there were times that I hit him in the gym, and I actually pulled the muscle on my back real bad because I hit him so hard, and I hit him so hard I hurt myself. And I remember he was fighting a guy, a heavyweight fight, and the guy was much bigger than the guy was about 270 pounds, but he was a big, more like fat guy, very flabby. And went to defense. The kid that I know lost, and he came up to me after the fight, and he was like, did I lose? I said, yeah, Bob, you lost. And he said, did I get knocked out? I said, no, Bob. I said, you didn't even get knocked down. I said, you went the distance, you lost a decision. No, I got knocked out. Did I get knocked out? And I'm like, no, Bob, you didn't. 2 minutes later, he corrected me. He said, Tony, did I get knocked out? No, Bob, you didn't. And I'm getting mad at him. I'm like, Bob, I'm going to take it to the 12th time. You didn't get knocked out. You went to the 12th. Are you lying to me? No, Bob, I'm not lying to you.
Sounds like he had the same symptoms I had.
Yeah, exactly. I remember one of my folks, you were talking about not remembering where you were from. I had a fight, and I won this fight. I was fighting a kid from Penn State. We were fighting in a neutral ground. I'd already put him down twice, but we were going back and forth. And he caught me with a right hand in the third round. And my knees buckled, and they were giving me a standing eight count. And I remember the referee looking at me, and I'm looking at him, and I'm like, shit, all right, five, six, and I'm focusing on the count, and I'm fine. Then he asked me a question. He goes, where are you? And it felt like I was there for an hour. And I also felt like it was a kid in class that the teacher just called on, and I don't know the answer. And I'm like, humming. And then I remembered where I was, and I actually screamed it at him. Just so he knew, I knew where the hell I was.
Yeah, that's one of the dangers of the game we're in, is head trauma.
Well, I remember it goes both ways, you know, like when you fought Rob Brewer down in Indiana at that casino apparently from what I heard about him, he woke up in the dressing room and didn't even know he'd been in a fight. Yeah, that was one of the devastating knockouts.
He was knocked out for a while. That was a scary one, you know.
I want to win the fight, and I want to
knock the guy out, but I want him to get right back up and be perfectly fine.
I didn't feel real good about that one. No, I mean, no one wants to see their opponent seriously injured. I mean, that's crazy to talk like that. You want to win, but I remember, it was a real small ballroom, and boy, I remember we had cage side seats for about $35, and yeah, that was. I mean, he was out for close to 5 minutes, I think. That was a bad one.
Yeah, you know, he fought Matt Masterson, and I was in Matt Masterson's corner. Matt won a decision over him, but in the third round, he caught Matt with a hook and dropped it. And Matt finished out the round, and he won because he had dominated the fight up to that point. And when the fight was over, I came in, you know, and said, hey, raise your hand. So they know that you're confident you won. And he said, no, there's still another round. He said, he says there's still more rounds. That was just the first round. I said, that was round number three, man. He said, no, we just started fighting. So I hear he had a concussion.
Yeah,
didn't even remember it afterward.
I mean, we're laughing about this. It's really not funny, but, you know, what are you going to do? That's the risk of the game. Everyone knows that going in. I mean, I've even had some headaches from the gym, I mean, for that matter. But
it's something you got to keep an eye on. You know, like I said, that one concussion I had scared me, and I told myself, if you don't let it heal, it becomes a chronic injury. Now, if you injure your ankle and you come back too soon and you re-injure your ankle and then now you got this chronic ankle injury, you walk around with a limp. If you injure your brain and you end up with a chronic brain injury, you can't go around with a bad. You can go around with a bad ankle. You can't go around with a bad brain. Yeah, it's something obviously that you see, in old boxers and. You know, now they're seeing a lot with old football players, and I don't want to, planning on being like that, man. So that was also one of the factors that I put into retiring.
Yeah, and I know that your chin came back, though, when you fought Brendan Seguin. That was an interesting one, too, back there around Christmas 2009, right here in my hometown, Akron. That was a five-round war. Boy, that was another one, and that one got pretty wild, pretty ugly. But your chin came through for you that night, too.
You know, I really feel like I could have knocked the guy out. I was having, like I was saying earlier, I just had mechanical issues. You know, if you look at some of my old fights, if you look at, like, when I fought Dan Hardy, I punched a certain way. You know, I used my hips more, and I don't know what happened. I got mixed up. I got took some bad boxing advice, and I developed bad habits. And I started fighting Paul, and I lost. Yeah, I'm not a finesse guy, and I don't know why I ever tried to be one. But I lost some of my power, and I started to get it back in the last 2 years. and I when I knocked three dudes out in a row with it. When I kind of got back to the way I used to punch, and it's not pretty, but it's a lot more effective. And I feel like if I would have fought Brandon Siegelin 2 years before or 2 years after, I would have got rid of the guy. You know, I wouldn't have had it wouldn't have had to go to a decision. But I was like a major league pitcher who was having mechanical issues. I just went out on the mound, and sometimes I had my stuff, and sometimes I didn't. And it was a mystery to me when it would show up.
Yeah, I think the whole thing with you is you like to keep it simple. And like in that interview before you fought Victor O'Donnell, or not Victor, the first O'Donnell, you fought two O'Donnells. Before you fought Mike, I remember your interview there was, you were asked, I think Bobich was doing the interview, wasn't he? Bobich was doing color commentary, and he says, what's your plan? And he said, oh, same as always, use my hands and knock this dude out. Very simple, not a lot of wasted words, just, you know, that's it. You know, that's the game plan.
Well, I mean, rocket science.
Now, Forrest, what would you say you enjoy most about being a fighter?
I like training. I enjoy the fitness. And I there's no feeling in the world like winning a fight, man. I tell you, I won this fight last Saturday, and I'm on cloud nine. And I will be for a little while. And I don't know how to explain it. Just there's nothing better than winning a fight, especially my kind of fight, like where you really dig in the trenches and just have a real caveman kind of fight. You know what? It's primal. There's a reptilian complex part of your brain that's hardwired that way to always to enjoy combat. And that's just what's fun about it.
And do you have any fighters out there that you have to watch every time they fight, or you try to pick things up from just fighters that you like watching?
I'm not as big of a fan of the sport, you know, watching the sport as much as I used to be. I got guys that I like to watch fight. I usually like just watching because I like them personally. I like Brian Stan. I like the way he fights. But, there's better fighters than him. But I just think he's a good guy, and I root for him. Clay Guida, he's another guy I always just kind of root for. Guida's not even really the kind of style of a fighter that I would, you know, that I'd normally like. But just because I like him, I would watch him fight. You know, when I started out, I really like Vanderlei Silva, Igor Bokchanin, that from that generation of fighters, like the guys that I watched. But nowadays, I hardly even know who all the fighters are anymore.
Well, I guess that means you're working hard on your game.
Yeah.
All right, well, we've only got a couple minutes left. Does anybody you want to get a shout out to or say hello to or thank or anything like that?
I just want to thank no one because everybody's against me. I always wanted to say that. Sorry. Everybody at the Strong Style Gym, Mark Carnelli's always helped me out. And if you're a fighter and you're from Northeast Ohio, you should train there because that's the best gym. You ain't going to get better fighters to train with, and you ain't going to get a better facility. So come to Strong Style.
I agree. I totally agree.
All right.
I'm biased, too.
Good morning. Well, thanks for joining the show tonight, Forrest.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And, we'll
a lot of memories.
On you. And
thanks again.
Sure.
Thank you.
All right.
Okay, buddy.
Okay, there's one last little story I wanted to get to before we close out tonight, and it's about a guy over in the UK, Conor McGregor. Actually, no, not Conor McGregor. Conor McGregor is his idol, I guess, but it's actually a guy named Kendrick. But he was born at Boston's Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and lived the first 5 years of his life in Boston, and now he lives in Ireland, and he's got an online campaign going to convince Dana White and other UFC officials to put him on the August 17th card at TD Garden. He's got a pretty impressive career. He hired boxing world champion Wayne McCullough to do. Actually, the UFC hired Wayne McCullough to do promotional work in Northern Ireland. But he's an Irishman. He's from Boston, and he wants to come back. So hopefully Dana White will do the right thing and get him in. So that's all we got.
Yeah.
Bye. And have a great week, everybody. And
all right, as always, let's enjoy the fights we got.
We'll have a lot of this weekend, so everybody enjoy them.
Actually, Tony, you have a request out for Harry Joe Yorgi for next Thursday, if I remember correctly. So maybe we'll at least get to talk to one of the fighters, all three of us. You know, we'll be able to watch it.
Well, I'm not bad.